Welcome to Extreme Jeans on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
You have found us. It's America's Family History Show, Extreme Jeans and ExtremeJeans.com. My name is Fisher. I am your radio root sleuth on the program where we shake your family tree and watch the nuts fall out. And there's been a little controversy over the last couple of weeks as the Family History Library in Salt Lake City, Utah announced that they're no longer going to be sharing microfilm with satellite libraries throughout the country, family history centers. And some people are very concerned about this. And so we thought, okay, well, let's go right to the source. We're going to have Diane Loosely coming on the show in about 8 minutes. She is the head of the library in Salt Lake City, Utah, and she'll explain what's going on with that and why you shouldn't be too concerned about it. She'll also tell us about some other things that are happening that's going to intrigue you concerning family history work and the Family History Library of Utah. Plus, later on in the show, it's been an interesting interview. I've kind of had this in the can for a few weeks because I wasn't quite sure when to run it. But it's an interview with a blogger named Beth Wiley. She runs a site called lifeinthepastlane.org. And not long ago, she wrote about the struggles of being a descendant of slave owners in the South. And with recent news and challenges in Virginia, I thought maybe it was time to hear what Beth has to say about how she's dealing with some of the challenges of her ancestry. But right now, let's check in with my good friend David Allen Lambert, the chief genealogist of the New England Historic Genealogical Society and American Ancestors.org. Hello, David.
Hello from Beantown. How you doing, Fish?
I am doing great. It was so nice. I was on vacation last week, went off to Beantown, to Boston, Massachusetts. I took in a Sox game. I went boating with a cousin in Connecticut and hung out with you guys at NEHGS. It's actually the first time I've ever actually visited there, David, and what an incredible facility in Boston.
Well, thank you very much. We're pretty proud of it here after 172 years. I must say that it was interesting that you came during one of our busy seasons. We had our Come Home to New England program, and you actually helped one of our assistants at the reference desk find an ancestor she didn't know.
Yeah. She was supposed to be helping me, and then we got talking, and I realized, oh, wait a minute, we share an ancestor in the 18th century, and she didn't have the information I did. So, yes, it was really quite fun.
Yeah, so our HR department will be calling you to work the reference desk when we have our next conference, just to let you know. Well, my first story for the Family Histoire News is some sad news, but after living 113 years, Israel Crystal, a Polish survivor of Auschwitz, has passed away. He was the oldest man in the world.
Wow, 113.
He was. In fact, he just recently celebrated his bar mitzvah because he was in World War I a liquor smuggler carrying liquor across the lines. I guess apparently he was a fast runner. Israel's life was very long, but unfortunately during Auschwitz, he lost his first wife and two of his children.
Oh, my goodness.
But he did live a long life and probably was an inspiration to many people.
Absolutely.
Our next story deals with not a super centenarian, but somebody getting close to 100. She's 95 years young, and the name Naomi Parker Fraley may not mean anything, but if you've ever seen the We Can Do It with Rosie the Riveter, with the pumped-up arm and the bandana,
yeah,
that is her.
Yes, this is only a recent discovery. People didn't know who inspired that particular poster, which didn't really become popular till the 1980s, but it's been determined now pretty much that it was this gal.
It really was. In fact, I can tell you every time I go to Washington, D.C., my wife asks for Rosie the Riveter cups, pins, and pens. So my wife will be very excited to know that the real Rosie is alive.
That's amazing, isn't it?
It really is. I'll tell you, some nights I sleep better than others. I got a new mattress recently. And I was thinking to myself, I said, you know, all the history and diaries we have, how did our ancestors get through feather beds and all that? Believe it or not, our ancestors didn't sleep like us. A report on a website called slumberwise.com says that our ancestors slept twice in the night. They say that they would sleep for a few hours, and then they would be up for a couple of hours, and then they would sleep through to morning. Now, I know about you. I get up in the middle of the night sometimes, but it's not usually for 2 or 3 hours.
No, but I would imagine they were taking care of a fireplace to keep the heat on in a cabin or something like that.
Either that or taking care of animals early in the morning, feeding them and going back to bed again.
Yep.
Even Chaucer in Canterbury Tales speaks about the first sleep and the second sleep of people, and that goes back to medieval days.
Interesting.
DNA, I'll tell you, it amazes me all the stories. This story deals with a Massachusetts lady. Elsie had her two children in Puerto Rico taken away from her after a failed marriage back in the 1970s. She has now been reunited with her two children after 46 years.
Isn't that incredible? The two boys were farmed out to different adoptive families, and then the one found the other boy somehow, and then they went together through DNA and located a cousin who knew the location of their mother and that she was still living in Massachusetts. And what a joyful thing for that entire family.
It really is. And I'm very delighted to know it's not just connecting our ancestors, but it's connecting families and reuniting them again.
It's the miracle of our times.
It really is. This week's Blogger Spotlight is featuring thevoice.fgs.org. Many of you may have heard of the Federation of Genealogical Societies. In fact, in a couple of weeks, from August 30th to September 2nd, FGS will be having their annual conference. But in their FGS blog, they speak of wonderful things going on in the genealogical industry, including the update to the 1812 Preserve the Pensions. As many of you know, FGS has raised money to help get the pensions digitized through the efforts of so many genealogists like yourself. However, it's kind of been stalled. This tells us that in September, preservation and digitization will continue past the letter M. So if you've been looking for that pension after that part of the alphabet, you're all set now.
That's good to hear. I'm waiting for S to come out, and it's been a long time.
Well, if you are not a member of NEHGS, AmericanAncestors.org, you can sign up for a free guest membership. And if you decide that you want to join after giving us a test drive, go ahead and use the checkout code EXTREME and save $20. Well, that's all I have from this side of the pond here in Beantown. Enjoy the rest of your summer and hope to see you soon.
All right. Thanks so much, David. And coming up next in 3 minutes, I'm going to talk to Diane Loosely. She is the director of the Family History Library in Salt Lake City, Utah. They recently announced no more sharing microfilm. Why is that? What's happening? There's good news in here. You'll catch it coming up in 3 minutes on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. And welcome back. It's America's Family History Show, Extreme Genes and ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth. And there's been a little bit of whining in some quarters in the genealogy world lately because FamilySearch.org has announced that they're no longer going to be making available microfilms to be shipped to libraries all over the place. And so we figured, all right, let's go straight to the source here. And Diane Loosely is here from Family Search International. How are you, Diane?
I'm just great. It's good to be here.
And you know, this is a question that's come up with a lot of people saying, wait a minute, I mean, I got to get my microfilms because I've been doing research on a long-term project. What say you about this? What's going on with it and why is it being done?
Well, this is a really exciting place to be because we're moving from a time when we fulfilled your needs to get access to records via microfilm to completely digital. And we've been capturing records now only digitally when we go out and we don't microfilm anymore. We capture them digitally. And now we're to the point where we've converted the majority of what's at the vault to digital images. And so you can access those online, which is great news for you because you can do it from home.
Right.
You can get access to it. Now, there's a portion that you have to go to a family history center or an affiliate library to get access to, but the majority of it can be accessed from home. And the way you find what is available is through Family Search. You can go to the historical records section and search the records, but also if you haven't gone and searched the catalog, so when you go under the search tab, there's catalog, that link, and go search for your location there, then you haven't seen it all because there's a lot of our digital collections that are not actually available through the historical records part of our website, but you have to go to the catalog to look at those.
And how much is being added, say, on an average day?
We digitize about 1,500 microfilm a day.
And how quickly do they get up?
They get published almost immediately.
Wow. And so these are browsable, though. They're not indexed yet.
Yes. These are not indexed. So it would be like looking at a microfilm, but on a digital viewer. Okay. So you see the thumbnails of each of the images like you would on a microfilm, and you can go through those images and locate. But it's actually, I find it much quicker to actually go through than a microfilm. Because, you know, the microfilm, you're doing like your arm's about to fall off because you've rolled to the end of the film. With the digital images, you have a little thumbnail view that you can navigate through, which is much
absolutely
quicker.
And I've had that experience. It's an incredible thing to see what's happening.
So the question people have is, what about my film? So we are planning, there will be a process by which they can let us know, this is the film that I need if it hasn't been digitized yet. And then we will prioritize that to be digitized more quickly so that they can get access to it more quickly. Now, the thing we found, however, is most people that ask us that question about a specific set of films, their film actually already is digitized.
Yes. Yep. But there's been a big drop-off, as I understand it, in requests because there's so much stuff online, and not just through Family Search, but through MyHeritage and Ancestry and Find My Past. What has the demand been like over the last few years? I mean, where was it at its peak? Let's start there.
Oh, we used to get millions of orders, you know, a year. But in the last while, it's dropped down to the tens of thousands. It's really significantly dropped off. And that was one of the reasons we felt like this was a good time to be able to do this.
And what's fun is you find some new record that you didn't know even existed.
Yep.
Now you're finding out, oh, it's been digitized or it's maybe even been indexed.
Yeah.
But to make that discovery and you go, oh, look at that. I didn't even know that that was around. And you go through and you find something new and exciting. Yep. It's great.
Well, and what's interesting is, so I'm the director of the Family History Library. I'm there a lot, but I have to actually plan to go do some research. And
yeah.
So I planned for two Saturdays in a row to go do some research. But when I went on to the catalog to check and get the films that I needed, I found I didn't even need to go to the library because they were online. So I could just do it from home, which was really nice.
So the library is turning into a virtual library.
Absolutely.
Ultimately.
Yes.
Do you think there will ever come a day where we won't need a library?
No, actually I don't. And I'll tell you why. So about 20% of the collection can only be accessed digitally from a family history center or the library or, you know, one of our affiliate libraries. And that's because of contractual obligations that we have. But beyond that, the libraries are a place of discovery. They're a place where you can get help, where people can sit beside you and assist you in being able to figure out how to discover your family. And we have the new discovery experiences that are coming into the centers to introduce family history to a whole new generation of people,
and
families,
they are so much fun.
Yeah.
So much. It's like the Disneyland of the genealogy world if you've never seen one of these things. If you've posted pictures anywhere with your family or someone else has, and you go in and you can plug in your information, and suddenly you're surrounded by this whole multimedia experience. Or you're discovering, oh, I'm related to Benjamin Franklin or something like this, and it's exciting for kids. You've got all kinds of great little ditties for people to play with.
Yes, and they're having a ball.
And you're so spreading them around the country, too. The first was in Salt Lake City. It's at the Family History Library. Where else do you have them?
We have one in Layton, and we have one in St. George.
Okay, both in Utah.
Just barely open, both in Utah.
Okay.
Yeah. But our plan is to actually make these experiences available in every family history center over time. Not the large touch screens, but available on the devices that are in the centers already so that people can discover in any center anywhere. And then we're also looking at moving some of the discovery experiences online so you can do it from home as well.
Wow.
So, yeah.
That would be fun.
Yes.
Are there any records in the world anymore that are still being microfilmed?
There are records that are being microfilmed for preservation purposes, yes.
Uh-huh. And does
now,
Family Search
us,
do that?
We don't.
Okay.
We don't continue to. We're doing digital capture almost everything. In fact, a lot of things that we do now are born digitally. That's the way that we start. And then it's just been this conversion process with the microfilm in the vault, because that's what we've acquired over many, many years.
Sure. How many reels are we talking about that you're going to actually wind up digitizing when it's all said and done that are in the vault right now?
So we have 2.4 million, more than half, have been digitized already. There's still a fair amount to go, but you have to remember that some of those microfilms would never be digitized because they might be a second copy of one that had already been digitized, so you don't need to do it twice.
Yeah, that's right. I've seen that with New York records a lot. You know, got
I'll say another
sets.
Filming.
Sure,
yeah,
and some are cleaner than the others.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right.
So we want to make sure we got a good quality scan, but we probably won't do those. And then there'll be others where, for licensing issues, we're not able to share them. So, for example, a record custodian, when we acquired them, said specifically you cannot share these digitally, so we won't be able to do that for those, but that's a very small percentage. And pretty much anything that's been circulating microfilm-wise could be circulated digitally. The only place where that's different is over the years, the laws around data privacy have changed in the various countries. And so we have had things that have been circulating in microfilm that maybe because of the change in the law, maybe shouldn't have been. And so those would have to have been restricted through the course of us going through and changing things based on the law change. And so if we discover those in this process of making them digital, those will not be accessible. But those are usually very recent things. You
sure,
know?
But how do you sort through 2.4 million and going, oh, wait a minute, I got a problem with this one, but I don't with this. Do you have legal people working on this constantly?
Yes, we do. And it is a big, big job because we have to go through all the contracts. We have to go through it for each of these collections. So you can imagine the amount of manpower this is taking to get to this point. So,
and you're figuring how many years now before the vault is completely done?
The majority will be done by 2020. There will be a period of time after that that we'll do some of the things that we probably would not publish online, but we want to make sure we have a digital copy of. So it will continue past 2020 a little bit. But the part that most of the people are going to care about will be finished by 2020.
So at what point are all the microfilms, there's no more distribution of microfilm to family history centers?
So
none at all.
You won't be able to order any new microfilms on September 1st. That's when that will come into effect. But that does not mean that anybody has to return their microfilms. All the microfilms that are out there in the family history centers, in the library, in the affiliate libraries, all of those can remain, and they're automatically converted to long-term loan, which means you can keep them for however long the people there locally want to keep them.
So I've got some microfilm that I collected way back. I can't contribute it now. You don't want it.
Right. In fact, we've tried to contribute the microfilm collection to some various locations. They're like, why would we want that?
What would we do with that?
Yeah,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, I'm just seeing the value of my microfilm reader I bought for $50 from somebody in the 90s. I'm going to have to chuck it at some point here.
Yeah, because it won't be needed anymore.
Exactly. Well, let's talk about acquisition, because this is exciting news. I mean, you're saying that from the peak of microfilm orders to now, I mean, it's like a 90-some-odd percent drop-off because so much material is in there.
Yeah.
By the way, I should mention that I've seen a lot of this stuff show up immediately after Family Search has had it on other places like MyHeritage and Ancestry, All Your Partners, Find My Past. And so the distribution is becoming massive very quickly as a result of the digitization process.
Yeah. I mean, Family Search has always been about getting you access to the materials that you need to find your family. And so we work with partners to accelerate that. As a nonprofit, we need to leverage the resources that we have and get it out to as many people as we can. So we do work with the various partners that you've mentioned and others too.
All right. So where is Family Search going now? What are the records you're coming up with that we're all going to get excited about?
Well, so actually,
the low-hanging fruit is pretty much done, right?
Well, yeah, it depends on the country. There are parts of the world where we haven't gotten into various archives and things and worked with them. So coming up shortly, we have a big push on the Nordic countries, actually. We've got Denmark, Sweden, and Finland, where there'll be some interesting collections coming available. We've been doing some things with Ancestry with Mexico, which is going to be a wonderful thing, and a few others. But one of the things actually we're most excited about is the fact that in Africa, you have people that are not documented, and the only way you know about them is oral history. And there are people in the villages in Africa who are the village rememberers,
right?
Who keep track of the generations in their heads and can recite them to you. It's amazing.
She's Diane Loosley. She's the head of the Family History Library in Salt Lake City, Utah, with Family Search International. And it sounds like a lot of good news associated with this whole thing about microfilm loans going away, strangely enough. And coming up next, with all the turmoil happening in the South and talking about the Civil War, I thought you'd want to hear from Beth Wiley. She's a blogger who recently wrote about her challenges of dealing with her slave owner ancestors. You'll want to hear what she has to say coming up in 5 minutes on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. And we are back. It's Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show, and ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth. And I think it was last week or week before that David Allen Lambert and I were talking about a blog site called LifeInThePastLane.org and an article that was written there by Beth Wiley of Oklahoma City talking about the complications of Southern ancestry. And I have Beth on the line right now. And Beth, nice to have you on the show.
Oh, it's a delight to be here. Thank you.
You got a lot of Southern roots here. Let's see, you were born in Louisiana. You were raised in Little Rock, Arkansas. You live in Oklahoma City, which is largely, I would say, Southern culture there, a little Midwest, right?
Yes, it's a good mix of the two.
And how long have you been researching?
Oh, on and off since I was in high school. My grandmother was an amateur genealogist, and she planted the seeds really early in me. I recall going to a family reunion in Union County, Arkansas, which is pretty rural, when I was a child, and seeing all the boards with the family photographs. So that really kind of was the beginning of my exposure to it. And in high school, I kind of picked it back up. And the last probably 5 to 10 years, I've really been more and more involved with it. And then I started my blog.
And it's a great blog. And it's really interesting to see your evolution that you've kind of been going through as you've investigated your Southern roots. We have a lot of Southern listeners on this show as well. I'm sure maybe many of them have similar experiences. For those of us who don't have Southern roots, and I count myself among them, talk about the journey that you take as you first get into genealogy and the excitement of that, and then some of the challenges you face. And I will say this, by the way, that every part of the country has something that they deal with from the past, maybe even in your own lines. So it's not just the South that this situation is created from.
Sure. No, absolutely. And I think for myself, when I started, I didn't really have any ideas of where my paths would lead. I knew that I obviously was born and raised in the South, and that at least a few generations previous to me would be Southern. But then as you get into it and you really kind of realize how deep that lineage goes, you kind of discover some things that are not the most pleasant. So I've discovered that many of my ancestors were slave owners. And as I mentioned in my blog, you know, reading their last wills and testament where they bequeath their enslaved individuals to their children, it's just very eye-opening and very jarring. It kind of gives you an unsettled feeling of, sure, you know, you want to admire your ancestors and you want to honor them, but you also have to recognize that they did some things that were not great.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the slavery issue has been really the curse of this nation from the very beginning, and it continues to plague us today as we try to resolve
absolutely
the past.
One of my favorite historians, Ken Burns, often refers to it as America's original sin, and I do believe that with all my heart.
Yeah, I think that's true. In the beginning, you talked about you were going to reunions and you were looking at pictures and you were getting excited. You didn't think about those things, I bet, at those times.
No, not really. And my parents always took me to historical places growing up. All of our family vacations were to battlefields or historic buildings, Washington, D.C. Growing up in Louisiana, we were very close to a lot of historical sugar plantations in Nacogdoches. We went to Natchez, Mississippi. They never kind of instilled in any sort of way that this was the better way to live or the way things should be, but they also didn't touch on perhaps the bad things about that livelihood. And so it was kind of a thing that you learn about in school, but then as you get older and you see more things in the news and, you know, just your own personal experiences of other individuals, you realize that that's a very dark period of our history. So my goal for myself is to, as I research my own family, my plan is to start putting any kind of information that I have about those that they've had enslaved on my blog. I'm currently working on a project now where I found a photo of my family, my Garrison family in South Carolina. The date's approximately 1875 to 1885. I'm trying to kind of date it based on the people that are in the photo. But there is a woman that is in the photo that is an emancipated slave, I assume. And so I'm trying to put together maybe who that person is.
Sure.
And so I'm working, that's an upcoming blog post that I'm trying to research right now.
Boy.
So I'd like to give her back her identity if I can.
Absolutely. How are you going about that?
I'm trying to first date the photo based on the family members that are in it. And some of them are young children, some of them are older. So kind of trying to put the family pieces of my family together so I can accurately date it. But also looking at census records, I've gotten a little somewhat far with that, but I think I'm going to have to broaden my search a bit. I believe I know who she is, but I need to verify it with other documents.
Sure. Now, as you've gotten into this, you've probably, like many of us, become the family historian for your family on all these different branches. True?
Yes.
And in the beginning, they turned to you with enthusiasm about it. How have they taken to the fact that you've got some concerns about the past?
Oh, I think they agree with me, and I think that they appreciate the efforts that I'm going through to maybe help others. We don't talk about it super specifically, but they are aware of it, and we just kind of, it is what it is, but I want to take it further and do what I can to help.
Sure. Now, have you had any interaction with some of the descendants of slaves that your ancestors owned?
No, not yet. I actually am working on another project. I've been contacted by someone who has a DNA match to me, but we're not exactly sure where that match is, and she's African American, so we are trying to kind of work through that. And we've got a third person now that also connects, perhaps, so maybe by process of elimination we'll be able to figure that out.
Isn't that amazing that we can do that kind of thing now? Absolutely incredible. I mean, it always keeps coming back to that, right? DNA.
Absolutely.
Have you found a lot of African American matches?
No, not yet.
Just this one?
Just this one. And she actually reached out to me.
So as you've gone through this journey and you've felt the darkness of some of the things that are back there for you, has that affected your self-image at all?
That's a good question. I haven't really thought of it in that way. There's certainly a lot of people that believe that current generations shouldn't be held accountable for the sins of their ancestors.
Right.
I haven't really decided how I feel about that, to be honest with you.
I've got quite a few scoundrels back in my lines. It had nothing to do with this particular issue, and most of them I just pretty much laugh at. But as you mentioned, Ken Burns' comment that it's the original sin of America, slavery, I think that's kind of a different issue and a challenge to us culturally right now, but I don't know how it's ever compensated for. Other than just trying to be as inclusive as we should be and should have been all along.
Absolutely. And I think that's why I feel like it's part of my obligation and my pleasure, actually, to be able to, if and when I can, help people to do so with their own searches.
Has this dampened your enthusiasm for research at all?
No, it just gives me a different perspective on it.
What else have you found in your research that you've blogged about in the past?
Well, I found out that my third great-grandfather, he was held prisoner in a northern prisoner of war camp during the Civil War. Peter Garrison was my third great-grandfather, and he actually served in the Confederacy. He was older than most of the people that were enlisted. But then I also have many patriots. I have a woman that may or may not have come across on a ship of brides to Virginia when it was a colony.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to pursue that, if it's true.
Yeah.
Kind of right now, one of those family legends that I'm not really sure if it's been distorted over the years, but I find that to be a fascinating part of history, and it'd be really interesting to find out more about that, because I can't imagine having to do that myself.
Yeah, exactly.
What kind of state her life would have been to have chosen that. So you never know what you're going to find.
Absolutely. It's lifeinthepastlane.org. It's the blog from Beth Wiley in Oklahoma City. Hey, Beth, enjoyed talking to you today. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was a delight.
And coming up next, one of our listeners has discovered a camera, a real old one, in their late aunt's attic. What's in it? Tom Perry, the Preservation Authority, will help him find out coming up in 3 minutes on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. And welcome back to America's Family History Show. It's Extreme Genes at ExtremeGenes.com. Fisher here, your radio root sleuth, and it is preservation time with TMCPlace.com's Tom Perry, our preservation authority. And Tom is on the road again. He's been enjoying his summer road trip in a place he cannot pronounce. It's it's Worcester, Massachusetts. I know it looks like Worcester, Worcester, in all this time, but it's Worcester, Massachusetts.
Worcester,
yes.
Massachusetts.
Absolutely. And you got a lot going on there because it's the Preservation Roadshow with our friends at NEHGS, and you're one of the speakers there, so congratulations on that. How's the trip been going, by the way?
It's been interesting. I'm glad to be in Boston now where things are kind of a little bit settled down. We stopped in Indiana to pick up our Jayco trailer. They build a special trailer for us for the road show where we can do scanning, all kinds of cool stuff right on the road to help people in parts of the country that don't have access to it. However, our beautiful Suburban, which I love very much, it's a 2007. We had the right rear sensor go out. They had to pull the wheel off to put a new sensor in and found a great big screw in the wheel.
Uh-oh.
And when we went to pick up the trailer, they go, hey, the trailer brakes on this thing aren't working. You need to go get some new trailer brakes.
But they got you on the road. You made it to Worcester, and that's all that matters.
Exactly. And the people back there were so nice. It was a small little town. There's 20 different RV manufacturing companies here. It's very Amish country. We stopped by some Amish places. and got some of the best food, the best hospitality anywhere. It was so exciting.
Well, the questions do not stop, Tom, even though you're on the road. And we got one here from Guy Hampton, who listens to us in Las Vegas on KXNT AM 840. And he said he went up into his aunt's attic and found a very old film camera. He doesn't know if it's stills or if it's movies, and he doesn't know what to do. I know you got some good advice for him.
Okay, what you want to do is you want to go into a dark room down in the basement or something. Don't go into a room and close all your drapes and think that there's no light in there. Because even though you can't see it, the film could still be exposed. So what you want to do is go down into a dark room, make sure there's no lights, there's no light coming in from outside, nothing, not even the little red light on an alarm in your ceiling or something, because anything like that could affect the film. So what you want to do is open it and put your hands inside and fill. And if you fill a plastic filling cassette, then you're probably okay. You can pop it out, and if any of it gets exposed, it's going to be a little one-inch piece, so it really doesn't matter.
Okay.
But if you get in there and you feel that there's two reels, like little teeny reels about the size of an Eisenhower dollar, then you've got regular 8 film, and if it feels like it's about a half inch to an inch wide, you've got the kind that's called the double run. In the old days, what you did is you popped your film in the camera, you shot it, then you flipped it over and shot it again, so you ran it two ways. So in essence, it was 16 millimeter film, but when they developed the film, they split it in half, and you get two 50-foot rolls. So people are always confused. They come in and go, oh, hey, I've got a 50-foot roll here. Well, no, it's actually 100 feet because it's a 50-foot double roll. So what you want to do, if you fill those rolls, it would be better to take that film, send it into a place in Atlanta and have it develop and have it come out blank than to have recorded over something that might become an heirloom to your family.
Now, I know he hasn't given you a whole lot of information here, Tom, but how old, just from the description he gave you, do you think this camera may be?
I'm probably guessing at the latest the 60s. Probably realistically, it's probably more like the 30s or 40s, the way he's describing it. And so what you want to do once you're in this darkroom, take some tinfoil with you too, then very carefully take those rolls out and wrap them in the tinfoil really, really tight so no light can get to them. And then there's a place in Atlanta called Film Rescue, which will develop film because they make the chemistry because Kodak stopped several years ago. So he only does it like 4 times a year. So what you want to do is you want to call him and say, hey, here's the model of my camera. Read off the side to him what it is. And then he'll probably be able to figure out when it is, when the time is to send it in so you can get it developed.
All right, Tom, let's take a break. More with Tom Perry on preservation coming up in 3 minutes on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. And we are back. It's our final segment of Extreme Genes for this week, America's Family History Show. We're talking preservation with Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com. And we got this great email from Guy talking about this old camera he found in his aunt's attic some time ago. And he doesn't know how old it is. He doesn't know if there's any film in there. And Tom, you're saying open it up in a dark place. Make sure there's not even a little red light in the ceiling because that could mess up any film that might be in there. What else do you have to tell Guy?
Okay, one thing that's really important, which you mentioned, you want to keep the light away from it. So once you take these little wheel-type things out of it, you want to make sure you wrap it in tinfoil so that there's no way any light can penetrate it, because you want to keep it in that so you can get it developed. Because like I say, even if this film is blank, it's worth taking the chance of developing something like that, because that could be some movie film of like your great-great-grandfather and grandmother, and there might not be any other photos of them. Now, one thing that's really good to do nowadays with Google, there should be some kind of a number on the side of the camera, or a serial number or something on the bottom. Go into Google and type those numbers in, and you might see your camera pop up, and they'll say, okay, this is the kind of film that went in it, because any information that you can collect on this, when you get a hold of the guy at Film Rescue in Atlanta that you can pass on to him, then that's going to give him better ammunition to know, oh, okay, this is what chemistry I need to develop it. We'll do the right kind of thing, and then, of course, once it's been developed, then we can scan it and give you incredible pictures as JPEGs if you want, or turn it into a film or a Blu-ray or a DVD or put it in the cloud or whatever, because this could be something that's like finding an old daguerreotype of a great-great-great ancestor or something. This is really, really special stuff.
And you're saying the earliest it could be is probably the 30s and the latest is the 60s. Boy, that's a wide span. It could cover many different generations.
Oh, exactly. In fact, these cameras were not cheap, and the film was really expensive too. So a lot of times they handed them down father to son, father to son. And so they could have gone through 2 or 3 generations. Nowadays, everything's disposable. You buy a video camera, oh, there's a new camera out. Give this to my kids to play with. I'm going to use a new camera. Back in the day, they didn't do that. And they were very, very careful about shooting film. They didn't just go, shoot, like I've got probably 17,000 photos in my iPhone. which in the old days when I used film would be unheard of because of the expenses.
Sure.
So this could be something very, very special and unique.
Now, would there be any way to know if this kind of camera would be exclusively for color film versus black and white, or were most of them for both?
Most cameras could take either kind. What you'd have to do, like I said, is go to Google and Google in the name, and they'll tell you what can go in it, what didn't go in it. But most of the old 8mm film, it took the same kind of sprockets. And so when they came out with the color film, they still used the same kind of sprockets. The only difference is the lenses were better, so it might not be the same quality. We just transferred some film from somebody from 1908.
No.
It was 16mm black and white. Oh, yeah. And it was absolutely incredibly gorgeous. I mean, I am just amazed at how beautiful it is.
How can something like that survive without being damaged?
Whoever had it, they were a wealthy family. You could tell that just by what was on the film. And you could say they had a nice house, a lot of beach scenes. And the person that shot the film, you can tell the guy knew what he was doing. So he took care of his film. And even though it took several generations to get to us, it was incredible when it got to us. And that's the thing that's so neat about technology. If we would have scanned this film, say, even 10 years ago, it wouldn't be anywhere near as sharp and beautiful as today. This is why we say on this show, don't ever throw anything away that's optical, film or negatives. Never, ever throw them away, even after they're scanned.
All right. He's Tom Perry. He's the Preservation Authority in Worcester. Can you say Worcester, Massachusetts, Tom?
Worcester.
Doesn't work. It never works. He's there for the NEHGS Preservation Roadshow. Have a great trip. Stay safe, and we'll talk to you again next week, buddy.
Sounds good. Thank you. My pleasure.
Hey, that is a wrap for this week. Thanks so much for joining us. Don't forget, sign up for our weekly Genie newsletter if you haven't done so already. And those who are subscribers by the end of August are going to be eligible for a drawing we're going to do for some great software from Heritage Collectors. And this allows you to tag your old photographs, maybe use them in calendars. You can sign up at extremejeans.com or on our Facebook page. Hey, talk to you again next week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family.
This has been Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel. Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org.